You are listening to another Voice of Freedom broadcast, financed through the free will donations of listeners like yourself. I'm Ernst Sundl, your host and moderator. The opinions expressed by our guests or in editorials and stories are always those of the originators. We believe that personal opinions freely expressed are not a danger to any democratic society. We don't have to agree with any or all of the opinions expressed by others. We owe it to ourselves, however, to listen, to evaluate, and to possibly learn something new or different in the process. You may reach us at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1, telephone 1-416-922-9850. And now we have another interesting program for you. I'm Ernst Sundl with another Voice of Freedom program. We are going to continue our study into Nazi-Zionist collaboration. That sounds shocking to some people, I know. But it is a project that has to be undertaken in order to kind of act as a shot before the bow of the strident anti-Germanism and anti-German propaganda that has emanated from especially Zionist sources in the United States. And in my trials and in preparation for my trials in Toronto, where I spent 9 years defending myself because I had dared to reprint an Englishman's writings, a small publication of 32 pages called Did 6 Million Really Die? The question of reparations and Nazi-Zionist collaboration was touched upon. And so I had to familiarize myself in much greater detail with what really happened in that bygone time in the early 1930s and 40s in Europe and around the world. I was quoting extensively from a most extraordinary book called The Transfer Agreement, The Untold Story of the Secret Pact Between the Third Reich and Jewish Palestine. The author is Edwin Black, and it is published by Macmillan of New York and London, a very prestigious publishing house indeed, where people like David Irving, for instance, had their books published before he began to question the Holocaust. When we ended our last program, I had spoken about a man called Sam Cohen. Sam Cohen was the chosen negotiator between the Zionists and the National Socialist government, who would kind of present the Jewish side. And I had mentioned how Sam Cohen was attacked as being a liar and a fraud and a traitor and a Nazi collaborator, an evil rogue, and so on. And Edwin Black, on page 84, ends the discussion of Sam Cohen saying that each side used him for what it needed, devil or deliverer, yet few ever understood that Sam Cohen was in fact a little of both. Now, the Sam Cohen wasted no time in getting help from the German government, help for emigration of Jews out of Germany and getting around a British policy which demanded that each Jewish immigrant to Palestine would arrive with at least 1,000 British pounds in cash, which was about $5,000 in those days. And $5,000 in those days could buy you a house. In other words, that was a substantial amount of money. In those days, an American car cost about $200. So you can see that $5,000 would be a huge amount of money. And of course, the Zionists, who had intended to take over Palestine for a Zionist, a Jewish state, they wanted wealthy people to come there, not impoverished people or down and out on their luck, as they stated and as Edwin Black repeats in this book called The Transfer Agreement. And now he says that the Germans agreed to that 1,000 pound stipulation. And he says that Simultaneously, the Zionist movement promoting German exports would not only increase desperately needed foreign exchange and domestic jobs, but would pierce a stake through the heart of the Jewish-led anti-Nazi boycott. At a time when Adolf Hitler was striving to expel Jews, increase Aryan employment, and reconstitute the treasury, the currency exemption would be justified. The Zionists would be awarded a currency privilege allowed no Aryan. So Sam Cohen, who was called a traitor by many Jews in the last 60, 70 years, in effect negotiated a sweetheart of a deal with Hitler's National Socialist government and, Edwin Black puts it succinctly in one sentence, the Zionists would be awarded by the German state a currency privilege allowed no Aryan. While Hartenstein, along with Schmidt-Rölke, the two men whom he negotiated with, granted basic approval to Cohen's plan, they suggested Cohen work out the operational details with Heinrich Wolf, German consul in Palestine. Wolf was the German official who functioned as the Reich's eyes, ears, and voice in the territory considered to be the center of the international Jewish movement. Cohen left at once for Palestine. Now, I want to kind of acquaint our listeners with a bit of the situation, the way Hitler found himself after he assumed power in 1933, on the 30th of January. Hitler was taking over a government that was in effect virtually bankrupt. And he was briefed by a number of his new ministers and by civil servants. And I'll get in here, for instance, Hitler had risen to power on the promise that he was going to terminate the Treaty of Versailles and that he was going to restore German honor, German prosperity, and so on. And so Edwin Black says on page 110, it's his chapter 12, where he expresses the fear of preventive war. He says, matters worsened. Quickly the leaders of Germany realized that the anti-Hitler boycott was threatening to kill the Third Reich in its infancy, either through utter bankruptcy or by promoting an imminent invasion of Germany by its neighbors. When the Nazis consolidated power in early March, Polish officials openly reinforced troop strength along the Polish corridor. This was in response to the Führer's bellicose threats to seize the Versailles-created territorial bridge. In late March, the anti-Nazi boycott helped push Poland from a heightened defensive posture to a near-hysterical readiness to invade Germany. On April 7th, von Neurath, Schacht, and other key officials briefed Hitler about the Reich's perilous condition in the wake of the accelerating anti-Nazi backlash. Emphasizing that the various neighbors were actively contemplating a preventive war with Germany while she was still weak, von Neurath told Hitler, quote, the gravity of the dangers threatening us should not be underestimated, end of quote. Foremost among the potential invaders was Poland. Poland, determined to preempt any territorial compromise. Other neighbors to the east, Romania, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, would have to be kept on friendly terms, principally through trade, to preclude any anti-German alliance with Poland. The West was also threatening, for Neurath reminded Hitler that when German Chancellor Brüning told the newspaper in early 1932 that Germany would consider stopping all reparations, France mobilized for possible invasion. The foreign minister warned that France might resume her threatening posture if the Reich persisted in its policies. Now, so far Edwin Black, page 110 and page 111. We will continue with that in a moment. Let me just say that when my Jewish advisor, who helped me as a behind-the-scenes advisor and later as a witness in my trials, mentioned all these facts to me, I was incredulous. I had never heard of this before. I always had this vision of Hitler being the head of this powerful German Reich and so on. And Poland threatening to invade Germany seemed utterly ludicrous, or France being considered a superpower then. And then he proceeded to explain to me the power relationship of that particular time, which really, really surprised me. And here is Edwin Black giving you the facts the way they really were. So, back to the transfer agreement, page 111. Von Neurath, Hitler's foreign minister, did not have to remind Hitler what happened when Germany defaulted on reparation payments in 1923. France did invade. The political chaos resulted in cyclonic inflation. The foreign minister was plain about the Reich's absolute military vulnerability. He assumed that France was the strongest military power in the world. Germany could not challenge her in the least and lagged 5 years behind the might of even her lesser enemy, Poland. Moreover, Europe vigorously opposed Germany's efforts to rearm, and Hitler's cabinet knew that the Jewish protest and boycott movement was in the forefront of political agitation to keep Germany a weaponless nation. So, von Neurath was forced to list Germany's main defensive assets not as guns and bombs, but as international goodwill and her value as a trading partner. Von Neurath's military statement to Hitler concluded, quote, "We shall first have to concentrate our political activity on economic questions in order to avoid, in all circumstances, warlike complications with which we cannot cope at the present time." End of quote. A very insightful capsule overview by this young Jewish writer, Edwin Black, about the German foreign policy and economic situation, as well as the military situation. And then he goes on to quote on page 111, "Then Schacht, the finance minister, told Hitler the dismal economic truth. Things were far worse than in 1930. Then foreign exchange reserves totaled 3.3 billion Reichsmark, which Schacht considered dangerously low. Current reserves had dwindled to merely 450 million Reichsmark. Therefore, the end of foreign exchange and hence viable international commerce was now in sight. Every last sum of foreign currency was being gathered, even from German banks overseas. Within months, perhaps sooner, foreign exchange would no longer be available. Some way must be found to prepare the nations trading with Germany for the abrupt cessation of payments," said Schacht, stressing his hope that hostile reactions like those feared from the French could be avoided. But Schacht had an idea, perhaps the only idea capable of saving trade relations. Massive blocked accounts, that is, frozen bank accounts, would create a giant pool of blocked Reichsmark, called Sperrmarks, which Germany could use to pay obligations. Debtors would have no choice but to accept the Reichsmark, and they would be unusable almost exclusively in Germany. The true owners of such blocked accounts, foreigners and emigrants, presumably could not all use their Sperrmarks at once, especially since they could not be removed from the country. Thus, the Reichsbank could trade them freely. Schacht's idea was to elevate this shell game to a pseudo-legitimate financial technique to save the German economy. During the April 7th conference, Schacht predicted that so many new blocked accounts could be generated that there would be money left over for the new needs of the Reich. Hitler ended the April 7th conference by insisting that Schacht's plan get underway at once. But the situation deteriorated rapidly. On April 12th, German Ambassador Moltke in Warsaw reported that the anti-Nazi boycott was inciting the Polish people and their leaders to military edginess. Everywhere the slogan is destruction of everything in Poland which is still German and boycott of everything which comes from Germany. Everywhere straw men labeled Hitler as being burned. He added that the Polish government's open support of the boycott against German goods as legitimate and useful was incontestable. Moreover, reported Moltke, the Polish foreign minister had warned him that any retaliation against Polish Jews or any others of Polish extraction living in Germany would be met with dangerous Polish countermeasures, the, quote, "consequences of which were unforeseeable." On April 22nd, German ambassador to Italy, Ulrich von Hassel, reported worst news from Rome. In a one-sentence telegram, Hassel relayed highly reliable information from circles close to the Czech president Masaryk that Prague was planning to support, quote, Polish intentions of preventive military action at the German eastern border, end of quote. And so the news went from around the world. The Jewish boycott took hold. German industry was being threatened. And the Germans, which came as a big surprise to me, were virtually going to be brought to their knees. And guess who came to their rescue? You guessed correctly. It was Sam Cohen, the Zionist. Sam Cohen became known virtually as the ambassador of the Reich that was trying to undercut the boycott against Germany. And he was the one that was used to kind of run interference for the Third Reich. And he would even pick up his messages as at German embassies and at German consulates, as he was running from hither to yon, trying to undermine the boycott against the Germans. And he was able to free the Germans from the clutches of the boycott in the end. Our friend, Mr. Edwin Black, says here, Sam Cohen's deal was, in fact, only the preliminary agreement. When discovered by the international Zionist hierarchy, it would be considered inadequate, delivering too little money and too narrow a variety of merchandise to Jewish Palestine. If the Jewish state was to be built, it needed more than Hanno Taya's transactions, more than the sale of a few dunams of orchards and so on. It needed the building blocks of a new society, everything from taxis to bridges, and it needed more than a mere transferred value of a million Reichsmark. It needed the sizable portion in cash of the billions that constituted German Jewish wealth. The result of a broadened transfer would be more than the expansion of Hanno Taya's few settlements. It would be the expansion of all settlements and the towns and villages into an economically, geographically, and politically cohesive state, Israel. A massive, historically irreversible agreement was thought, a final solution to the persecution of the Jews. The plan was not to rescue for a relief project. It was the Zionists would have labored for an agreement for Jews fleeing Germany without regard to where they sought refuge. Instead, Jews would be allowed to bring assets out of Germany to rebuild their lives, but only if they liquidated their European existence and rebuild those lives in Palestine. The correct word then for Sam Cohen's deal and the arrangements to follow was not rescue. It was not relief. It was, in fact, transfer. The point between the philosophical spheres where Zionist and Nazi circles touched. Now, my friend and advisor and witness during my trial, expert in Jewish and Zionist affairs, Joseph Ginsburg, said that he knew several friends who left under this Havara agreement to go to Israel, and that they were able to take along their belongings. That they took along, one man took along 1.5 railroad carts of furniture and of machinery to set up a business in Palestine, and that was in 1934. And so this plan that the Zionists worked out with various representatives of the German Reich, with the full approval of Adolf Hitler, in effect, did start the brain drain, if you wish, or the transfer, at least, of brains of highly skilled Jewish administrators, judges, civil servants, professors, doctors, engineers, and so on, into Palestine, which was the foundation for the later state of Israel. And there was also this story about the Yellow Star. You know, many people said that the Yellow Star was a terrible thing, and that the Nazis humiliated the Jewish people, and that this was inhuman and so on. And I had mentioned in a previous broadcast that my informants told me, including Joseph Burke, that this was not felt at the time in 1933 to be such a terrible thing. And here is what Edwin Black has to say in page 176 about this particular episode. He says, "Perhaps no more dramatic example of German Zionism versus German Jewry exists than a Jüdische Rundschau article entitled Wear It With Pride, The Yellow Spot, written by editor Robert Welch. This article appeared April 4th, 1933, as one of the first German Jewish comments following the shock of the aborted April 1st anti-Jewish boycott actions. Decades after the fact, Welch's article is held up as an act of courage, comforting the Jewish community in a moment of anguish while the nation around them was reviving the medieval concept of Jews wearing an identifying yellow spot on their clothing. In fact, Welch's article was a barbed chastisement of German Jewish assimilation in Germany at the very moment when Jews were struggling to preserve their legal status as citizens." So much for that. Now, the idea of the Germans setting up the Zionist movement in Palestine has reverberated around German-Jewish dialogue and so on. And it has always been a kind of a discussion behind closed doors, because of course Hitler and his government were so demonized that it seemed like an act that no Jews would be capable of. Well, in effect, was it such a dastardly act, or was it actually an act that the Jewish leadership could be quite proud of? After all, their goal was, ever since Theodor Herzl wrote the book, The Jewish State, Der Judenstaat, that anti-Semitism was a natural byproduct of Jews dwelling in these foreign countries, or that Jews were perceived, even they themselves perceived themselves, as being a kind of a foreign body amongst the nations where they were dwelling. So the Zionist movement was known to Jewry, and it should have not come as a surprise to anyone that they would seize this chance to get skilled Jews out of Germany and ultimately out of Europe, because it would mean that they could start a state quickly, and if that state was even financed, let's say with this money that these people were bringing out, or that they were able to trade with Germany, then that would mean that the new state, or the new budding state, or the new embryonic state, or the new foundation for a state was far more firmly laid. Up until that time, as Edwin Black said in his critique of Theodor Herzl, that he was a kind of a utopian dreamer, and that he had these flights of fancy and so on. Well, the Zionists that were around during Hitler's time were actually quite ruthless, and even approached the National Socialist government by saying that we are approaching this issue in a very unemotional manner. And they pointed out that since they were to remove emotion from the discussion, that they would be the ideal partners in this particular policy. So, once again, what we are seeing then is that there was indeed German-Jewish collaboration to defeat the boycott organized by Rabbi Stephen Weiss, which was supposed to bring Germany to its knees. And Sam Cohen, who negotiated the deal together with others, Chaim Arlo Sorov, head of the political department of the Jewish Agency, and so on. They brokered this agreement, and they basically made it themselves a kind of a secret, wanted to keep it secret, because naturally world Jewry at that time was not exactly the almost universal body that they are today, or at least they didn't speak with as single a voice as they do today. And he talks about revisionism in Zionism on page 142. And as we are closing this program, I think since we are considered modern day revisionists, I should bring this in and mention something to it. Revisionist Zionism rejected Jewish exclusivity. They wanted a nation of ordinary Jews in a mixed urban rural society. Others wanted a kind of a, like the Mapai, they wanted a labor Zionism. And they saw Palestine as the home for a Jewish elite that would toil in the noble vocations of manual work and farming. Their orientation was communal, socialist. They wanted collective farms and villages. Moreover, labor Zionism desired the many, but not the multitudes. Mapai's Israel would not be for every Jew, at least not in the beginning. At first, Israel would be for the approved cadre of pioneers, and Mapai wanted gradual constructive programs to build the Jewish homeland. Dunam by dunam, meaning square inch by square inch or square acre by square acre. So he discusses here what revisionist Zionism rejected this Jewish exclusivity. They wanted this ordinary nation of a mixed urban rural society, that the system would be free enterprise, not socialism. And revisionism believed that Palestine could not be acquired a nibble and a shipload at a time. Only by rapidly transferring the largest number of Jews in the shortest amount of time would the Jews constitute a sudden majority in Palestine that could declare a state. So you see, we have here all the conflicts of Mapai-dominated Zionism and revisionism became a life or death issue with the rise of Hitler. Revisionists, on the other hand, were heavily fascist and profoundly influenced by Mussolini. Hey, we are talking here Jewish revisionists. We are heavily fascist, not German revisionists, not the guy in front of the other microphone here, Ernst Zündel. And Vladimir Jabotinsky was a Jewish revisionist. And labor Zionists, especially David Ben-Gurion, were fond of calling Jabotinsky the Jewish Hitler. So you see, revisionism was extant in the 1930s with Jewish movements around the world. There was Zionist revisionists, we now find out, and there are Holocaust revisionists today, and so I'm not quite sure why they're giving us such a hard time. However, I just want to say, we will leave this subject of the transfer agreement alone. You can get the book at your local library. It is published by Macmillan, and the title is The Transfer Agreement. The author is Edwin Black. I am Ernst Zündel. I recommend that you look into this subject, and you will see Germans and Nazis in a new light, and you will see Jews and Zionists in another and different light. Jews are not all good, Germans are not all evil, not all Germans are evil, and not all Jews are good. So this is my message for today. I am Ernst Zündel. Open your hearts and your minds to the new reality. We are located at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, postal code M5A2L1. Our telephone 416-922-9850. If you want books on these subjects, write us, send us a small donation, and we will send you a book list or an audio tape or video list. Auf Wiedersehen, Ernst Zündel here.